You're listening to Midori Hau's first broadcast on the 1st of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show:
the Israelis are in no mood now to negotiate with Hamas, not about political issues and certainly not about a soldier.
The Gaza ceasefire lasted just a few hours and now an Israeli soldier has been captured. We'll discuss what this means for the conflict with Sky News' Tim Marshall and Jim Hoare from SOAS here in the studio. We'll also discuss the unraveling security situation in Libya and why the US senators are up in arms over a spy scandal. Then we check in with our Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg to see what is making news on the East Coast of the United States. And later:
are you here to pay your respects or to remove any evidence? The priest frowned. Evidence? Evidence of what?
We will hear part five of our week-long Mediterranean murder mystery.
And the winner is Marie Rose Bertolacci.
We will also get a review of Italian films from Luca Mastrantonio, and we will have a song or two. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest news.
Dozens more have died on what was meant to be the first day of a 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza. The truce fell apart after just a few hours, with Israel resuming operations and saying Hamas had fired rockets just 90 minutes into the ceasefire. Israeli forces are now searching for a soldier who is believed to have been abducted. At the UN, Stephane Dujarric, who speaks for the Secretary-General, appealed to all sides to halt the violence.
Instead of giving both sides, especially Gazan civilians, a much-needed reprieve to let them attend to their injured, bury their dead, and repair vital infrastructure, this breach of the ceasefire is now leading to renewed escalation. The Secretary General urges both sides to show maximum restraint and return to the agreed 72-hour humanitarian ceasefire that tragically lasted such a brief period of time.
Gaza's health ministry says that 53 people were killed in the latest Israeli shelling and two soldiers were also killed. Haris Rafiq from the anti-extremism think tank the Quilliam Foundation says it's now likely that Israel will press on with its campaign.
I think this is one of the best opportunities that Israel certainly have had since Hamas's inception of actually destroying the Hamas infrastructure, the Muslim Brotherhood infrastructure, and certainly countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait certainly want them to do that.
Dutch and Australian forensic experts have returned to the scene of a Malaysia Airlines crash in eastern Ukraine. A 70-strong team has set up a base, but fighting has continued nearby. 10 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in a rebel ambush on Thursday. Australian officials say that up to 80 bodies remain at the scene of the crash, more than 2 weeks after the loss of flight MH17. Uganda's Constitutional Court has struck down the country's harsh anti-homosexuality laws. It's 6 months since they came into force, threatening long prison sentences for a crime described as aggravated homosexuality. A number of Western countries cut aid to Uganda in response. The country's government could launch a challenge to today's ruling. The World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak in West Africa can be contained, but it's warning affected nations will need outside help. More than 700 people have died across Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea. Quarantines are now being imposed in the worst affected areas. Paul Garwood, who's from the WHO, says a new $100 million response plan will step up support for the region.
This includes doctors, nurses, logisticians, epidemiologists, etc., communications experts, social mobilisation experts to talk with members of the community, to get the messages out about what to do, about to present at health facilities, about, you know, to ensure that they get there early for treatment.
Rescue workers in Western India say their hopes are bleak after a landslide killed at least 52 people and left more than 100 more buried under mud. Poor weather is continuing to hamper operations at the scene in the remote village of Malin, though officials say they've made a little more progress in the last few hours. China says 9 suspected militants have been shot dead in the western province of Xinjiang. Another suspect was captured. Chinese officials say their operation neutralized what they're calling a terror gang, which in China is often shorthand for Islamist militants. It's the latest violence in Xinjiang, which for 18 months now has seen a series of attacks linked to separatist movements. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News, and Jim Hoare from SOAS here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Let's begin our discussion with the unravelling situation in Gaza. Earlier today there was some hope because both sides agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire, but just after a few hours the silence was broken and attacks continued on both sides. There was also news that an Israeli soldier was kidnapped by militants. There are also some reports that the nationality of the soldier could be British. Here is Britain's Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond.
Diplomacy is never dead. We've always got to keep trying. But it is obviously extremely depressing that this ceasefire that we've all worked so hard to get broke down so quickly. And if the reports that Hamas broke the ceasefire are correct, then that is very serious indeed, as is the kidnapping of the Israeli soldier, which will make it all the more difficult to re-establish a ceasefire to allow a humanitarian pause in Gaza.
Britain's Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond there. So where do negotiations go from here? Tim Marshall from Sky News, let's begin with you. What are the implications of this kidnapping? How much of a bargaining chip is this for the Palestinians?
Oh, it's huge. It's the most significant thing that's happened that's going to affect where we go over the next few days. I mean, the most significant thing is the loss of life on both sides. But Benjamin Netanyahu was at 87% approval rating. It had started to drop his approval rating, but only because he wasn't going in even harder in Israel. He will now have the absolute backing to go in. I mean, if you could imagine it being harder, he will go in even harder. Second way it's significant is that absolutely this captured soldier will be a bargaining chip as they go for the next round of negotiations. I think you're in now for 2 or 3 days of really bitter fighting before they get back to the Americans and the Egyptians round a table. And crucially, there are about 100 Hamas fighters, we think, fighters have been captured by the Israelis over the past 4 weeks. Given what's happened in the past, I wouldn't rule out swapping 100 for one. The Israelis have done that before.
Jim, do you agree with all that?
I do indeed. It seems to me that we are in for a period, a longer period of fighting, of pushing each other very, very hard before there's any chance of anybody sitting down. And I agree about the business of 1 for 100. I mean, that seems to be the sort of going rate in these sort of exchanges. I'm a bit puzzled by the idea that there's a British man involved, and presumably has dual nationality. But I'm not sure Britain is going to be able to play much of a role in all this.
No, I was thinking, I noted that as well. It may be dual nationality. That will actually spark what really is a side issue, and that is the idea that Brits go to join the IDF. Because some British Jewish men, well, actually women can as well, because of the dual nationality thing, they can do. That will play into a different debate, and that is about people that go over, British Muslims that go over to Syria and Iraq to fight. Why are they called terrorists? Now, I'm not taking sides on either of these issues about whether they should or they shouldn't. But I do think if he does turn out to have dual nationality and one of them being British, that will play into the internal British debate. But as I said, compared to what's going on over there, that is very much a side issue.
All right.
I'm also thinking about what's going on. What's the approach the US is going to take, considering that we know that there are also many Americans fighting there?
Well, perhaps somebody could have a word with Kerry, the Secretary of State, and actually tell him who the players are. Because for the last ceasefire, which was ridiculous, that he put forward, never mentioned the tunnels. So the Israelis were hardly about to sign up for that. It never mentioned Hamas even thinking about disarming. And he went to Turkey and Qatar when the ceasefire fell through. Turkey and Qatar are the biggest backers of Hamas. He needs to go to Egypt, and he needs to go to Israel, and he needs to talk to the Israelis and the Egyptians, because those are the three parties that can bring the pressure to bear on Hamas in various ways. And it's only the Americans that are going to do it. But I'm afraid that we agree, don't we, that there's several days at least more bloodletting before they can put something into place to get around the table.
Yes, no, I would agree with that entirely, that the Israelis certainly are going to push very hard so that they are in a stronger, as they would see it, in a stronger position when negotiations actually begin. And the kidnapping or the capturing of an Israeli soldier will make the other side very keen to keep the whole thing going a bit longer so that they bring more pressure.
But interestingly, already we can now see the outline of the peace deal, and it will be: give us back our 100, we'll give you back your 1, we promise not to fire any more rockets, you promise this, that and the other, and to perhaps have a partial opening. But all that's going to happen is that each side will then stop for about 4 years before the next round, because the fundamentals will not have changed.
Exactly. Tim, what I find interesting is that you earlier mentioned Kerry, but where is Obama here?
I don't think Obama's that bothered. Obama's attention is elsewhere. If it's not on the golf course, it's certainly towards Asia Pacific. I mean, he really does focus there. He does not want to engage America too deeply in this. He has delegated it, and I think that you could argue quite rightly, to his Secretary of State. So I don't think Obama's really in this. I think Kerry is driving. I just don't think Kerry's had a particularly good performance so far. That said, America is the indispensable country, and they are the only ones that can really bring pressure to bear where it needs to be brought.
The impression I have all along is that Obama's interests are actually not terribly strong in foreign affairs.
No, absolutely not.
It's domestic issues that concern him, and domestic issues that get his attention first. And he's quite happy to leave foreign affairs to others, whether it's Hillary Clinton or now John Kerry.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, could you talk me about the different factions of Hamas? Could the political wing have agreed to this ceasefire whilst the military wing didn't? Are we seeing some sort of divisions here?
I fear you've picked the wrong person here. I really do not know very much about the Middle East. I know the broad story, I know the history of how it all came about. But if you ask me about specific groups within one or other side, I'm not in a position to answer.
I'm going to redirect the question to Tim then.
I think it's like Sinn Féin IRA in the Troubles in this part of the world. I don't see the distinction between the political wing and the armed wing. The political wing controls the armed wing, as far as I know. Khaled Mashal, who's over in Qatar, controls it. I mean, look, I don't know if the Hamas deliberately violated the ceasefire, but you could put together a scenario where they knew there was the ceasefire and actually used it to go down these tunnels and to get the Israeli, because that is a holy grail for them, to get an Israeli, because they know the price. Very briefly, if I might venture to slightly controversial areas, the tunnels, what an Israeli intelligence failure. They didn't know that they had them. Mm-hmm. Secondly, on the tunnels, $90 million to build them, if only people had spent that money, which was mostly from Qatar and all that cement, building some schools and some hospitals.
The situation would be very different then, indeed. Finally, do you think we are sensing a change in public opinion as we continue to see the death toll rise on the Palestinian side?
Which public opinion? Which public opinion are you referring to?
Exactly.
In Britain, in Asia, in Europe, or in North America, or where? I mean, I think the problem is for everybody except those actually directly involved on the ground is that whatever happens, and I agree with Tim's point about you'll get an agreement on a ceasefire and it'll last X years, but it won't last forever because the basic problem is not being addressed and cannot be addressed probably now after all these years. It's there, it's not going to go away. The grievances are bitter on both sides. The Israelis are the stronger in theory, but in practice can't actually solve the problem as they perhaps would like to do so. So I think that the public opinion is probably very much along a plague on all your houses, but where that gets us, I'm not sure at all.
Public opinion in the UK, 62% think that Israel may have committed war crimes, 64% think that Hamas have committed war crimes. And I think it is a plague on. I mean, if you're talking about the general public, they don't actually care that much, most of them. But opinion formers and people that care passionately about foreign affairs, it is number one topic. And around the globe, opinion is turning against Israel, and that is a direct result because of the death toll. And the debate about the blockade is, or it is a partial blockade, is now up and running. And that for me turns on, is the partial blockade a result of rocket fire, or is rocket fire a partial result of the blockade, which came first? And then you get involved in this awful chicken and egg. I would say that the Israelis over the past few years have become increasingly hardened to the idea that world opinion is turning against them, because they think, well, what, you know, number one thing is to protect ourselves, and they actually care less than they used to about the world.
I think that's very true, that the attempts at public relations coming from the Israelis are almost laughable at times. You can almost hear the contempt in the military spokesman's voice, I'm afraid.
Jim and Tim, let's leave the crisis in Gaza and let's move to the unravelling security situation in Libya. Tunisia has closed its main border crossing with Libya after a flood of foreign nationals tried to break through a crossing to escape warring factions in Tripoli. Earlier this week, the same border crossing saw British and American diplomats fleeing the capital. This is the worst fighting Libya has seen since the fall of Gaddafi in 2011. How close are we to a complete breakdown of order in Libya now?
I think we're past it. James, go ahead.
Yes. My view is that it's broken down, that yeah. Libya is effectively a non-functioning state
yeah.
With warlords, or the equivalent of warlords operating. I think the British have actually kept some diplomats there.
Yeah, the embassy's still open, but it's only a very, very few staff. And they've said, all Brits, get out of town.
It's very interesting the way that once we always used to stay in places. You know, if there was a problem, you stayed. You didn't run away, because how else can you report it? Now they go. I suppose it's things like the death of the American ambassador in Benghazi.
Well, it is because you will not now simply be arrested and put on trial as a spy. You will have your head cut off.
Yeah.
And that's why. It is a non-functioning state. It fell apart very quickly after the brutality of Gaddafi. The Romans and the Turks ruled it in a series of areas, not as one country. It was the French, the Italians, and the Brits, but mostly the Italians that came along and said, right, this area is now called Libya, and you're all Libyans. And they said, what? And it's fallen into Tripolitania, which was from 2,000 years ago, Cyrenaica, where Benghazi is, from 2,000 years ago, and I don't see any way of putting it together.
Do you see this as a broader failure of Western intervention in the Middle East?
Absolutely.
Spring gone wrong.
The Arab Spring gone wrong. The whole intervention thing was, in my view, a big mistake. That there was no real plan for what you do afterwards. And now we're seeing that in reality. That you take away an existing state. It may be a nasty state. It may be an unpleasant state. But it was a functioning state. And you put nothing in its place. You can't expect democracy to grow. We were talking about this earlier, Tim and I. You can't expect democracy to grow suddenly. It doesn't. It takes a long time.
Yeah, we're now progressing towards a debate where people can actually say, actually something doesn't have to be done without being howled down as if you don't care about issues. Because I think what's happened in various countries has proved that it is an option not to do anything, because doing something might make things worse. But look, Liberia and Macedonia were two brilliant operations, brilliantly conceived, intervention and a plan of action and then a follow-up for years afterwards, and both places were clamped and are now functioning countries. Elsewhere, notably Iraq and to a lesser extent Libya, the plan for the day after simply wasn't good enough.
So what is your conclusion? Is there anything that can bring stabilisation to Libya?
No.
Time, perhaps.
Dear boy.
Yeah. I think in the short term, no. I think that the growth of these dissident groups, if you like, not dissident groups, but separatist groups, is now too well established for anybody to come along and say, oh, we're going to intervene again.
Yeah, and people think that democracy is about putting a vote in a box every 4 years. It's about civil structures. I mean, we were joking earlier. It's like having the Women's Institute. You need a Women's Institute. You need the Cubs. You need the Brownies. You need a civil society. And they didn't have one because Gaddafi absolutely crushed it. And so putting a mark against a ballot sheet every 4 years, that's not democracy. And they've got too many factions who want a cut of the oil and a cut of the gas. And I'm afraid I see no way of putting Libya back together in the near future at all.
Tim Marshall and Jim Hall, let's take a short break now. And when we return, we'll hear whether we could see the end of Christianity in Iraq, and we'll also discuss a spy scandal gripping American Senate.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Brown.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 2022 in Helsinki, 1822 in London and 1322 in New York. Still with me here in the studio is Tim Marshall and Jim Hoare. Let's turn our attention now to the rise of ISIS in Iraq. The Islamist group continues to control large parts of Iraq, and one of the groups who are proving to be one of the biggest victims are the country's Christians. The Islamic State has told non-Muslims in Mosul that if they do not convert to Islam or pay a large tax, they will face death. Most have all but fled. Many Christian places of worship have also been destroyed. Are you with me with this, if I say that it seems like everyone has stopped caring about the rise of ISIS as the world is fixed on other problems?
I'm not sure that's the issue. I think that the world has all these other problems, and it's trying to prioritise which ones you put first. And Iraq, since we intervened and solved the problem, has steadily deteriorated into a state of war. But there's no will now that I can see to go back in. And so it just... people just tolerate what's happening.
Yeah, because it's limited about what we can do.
Yeah.
Where I think the media... I mean, look, the State Department probably hasn't got a policy on what to do about Mosul's Christians, because it's not going to do anything about Mosul's Christians. It's going to try and do something about ISIS in the long run, and various, the Quai d'Orsay and the Foreign Office probably don't. The media has not concentrated on this, and even they have a get-out clause in that when the Christians began to be slaughtered a couple of weeks ago in Mosul, at least 300 have died in one mass shooting, they were in the middle of Gaza, and it is hard to focus on lots, and the Ukraine, of course, is front and centre. So it is difficult, but this is an ongoing problem about Christians in the Middle East in general. And Christianity, I think, in Iraq is probably at an end this decade after 1600 years. These guys from ISIS even destroyed the Temple of Jonah, Jonah is in the Quran as a righteous peacemaker of the messenger of God. Even the Quran likes Jonah. And these guys are so off the wall that they thought, oh, it's a Christian icon, therefore we shall destroy it. I mean, that's how off with the fairies they are. But it's working. The Christians are being pushed out of Syria. They're being pushed out of Iraq. They're being pushed out of Palestine. And it's getting to a situation where it could tip, and there could be the end of the Christianity in the Middle East. I think that's not yet there, but it's the end of Christianity in Iraq, more or less.
And I don't think any Western government is actually going to intervene and do anything about it. It's an awful problem for those concerned, but it must seem like a relatively small problem compared with the bigger one of the whole area seeming to collapse or the state's collapsing.
It's really sad that I know quite a lot of Arabic Christians, and they were bewildered about why nobody cares. I think it's partially because most of Britain is a post-Christian society. Much of Europe is a post-Christian society. So there isn't that immediate identification with your brethren over there, because most people over here aren't Christians any longer.
Let's continue with one more topic before I let you go. Let's touch on a spy scandal that is hitting Washington's most powerful politicians. Back in March, Senator Dianne Feinstein made the allegation that the CIA was spying on the chamber's members because of their investigation in the agency's torture program during the Bush years. It was an allegation that the head of the CIA, John Brennan, denied.
As far as the allegations of, you know, CIA hacking into, you know, Senate computers, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, we wouldn't do that. I mean, that's just beyond the scope of reason.
That was the head of the CIA, John Brennan. But now a report by the Inspector General of the CIA says that Dianne Feinstein was indeed right. The CIA was spying on U.S. senators. Tim Marshall from Sky News. The illegality of this is just unprecedented. Was John Brennan lying, or do you think he just didn't know?
Or was he being economical with the truth? Look, I think it's possible he didn't know, seriously. As I understand the story, the Senate Intelligence Committee, headed by Feinstein, needed to investigate the allegations of torture within the CIA. And so the CIA themselves set up an internal network called RDINet. And they gave the Senate committee members access to it and then set a firewall within it so that only they could access these files. It transpires now, despite John Brennan's, what he said earlier, that some CIA members were actually going round through the firewall and finding out which committee members were looking at which documents. Now, that is possibly a constitutional crisis, not crisis, but it's possibly breaking the US Constitution. However, I don't think he's going to resign. I don't think he's going to get sacked because he's a real confidant of President Obama. It's down to Feinstein now if she's going to accept the apology and say, please don't do it again. Where it plays is that yet again the CIA or a Western intelligence, you know, the ones that are on the side of the angels, have been shown to behaving badly, and it's another blow. I do think that they are sometimes on the side of the angels, but there's an angel who once fell all the way, and he's called Beelzebub.
Do you think this is going to finally result in some sort of change in the practices of the US intelligence community?
Yeah, for about 30 seconds. I'm sorry, if you give people an awful lot of power, they will use it, and Mr. Brennan, when he said he didn't know, I suspect he was right. But he would say that he's in busy. Any case, wouldn't he? Yeah. I mean, he's not going to admit that this was an error or this sort of thing was going on. We've seen the same in the UK over the question of records being kept on MPs and access to MPs' emails and so on, and telephone calls, which is supposedly not supposed to happen. So I'm afraid, you know, I was in government for 33 years. We were largely on the side of the angels, but I suspect that all of us do things from time to time that we shouldn't really be doing.
I know people that say, look, if we only had to deal with Sweden, it'd be fine. But we don't. We have to deal with X, Y, and Z as well, and therefore rules can get bent. And I actually think that the public in the Western democracies are quite happy to have the rules bent but not broken. When you are shown to have bent and broken them, then it's embarrassing and you must do something about it. But I think there are absolute limits. And I think that the waterboarding torture, which you could have a view on whether it's allowable or not, and eventually the Americans decided it was not allowable, but you cannot cover it up and lie to your publics and your government about it. And at that point, public goodwill stops because, you know, most people know that lines are fuzzy, but once you've gone right through them or rubbed them out, you've gone too far. But the basically, biggest crime, they got caught. And I agree that fundamentally they won't change, but they will have tighter laws and the Intelligence Committee will hopefully have greater scrutiny of them.
That was... Do you want to continue, Jim Hall?
I was just going to make a point you made earlier, that those who are concerned about these things will be concerned, but the great mass of people will not be in the least interested.
Did you know that the whole thing about Snowden, the whole Snowden affair, doesn't play at all with newspaper readers, with radio listeners, and with the television watchers? It plays with us because we're liberal intelligentsia gossipers, but it does not play. Most of the publics don't care. They think, I trust those guys to keep me, well, partially trust them to partially keep me safe.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. That was Tim Marshall and Jim Hoare. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Tu vai a Monaco, vada a City Check.
From London,
London. London, caralho.
De Londres, de
Londres. This is Monaco 24.
Here on Midori House, during the following 30 minutes or so, we'll head to America's East Coast to check in with our correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. We'll hear part 5 of our Mediterraneo murder mystery, and we will review the latest and greatest in the world of Italian film. But before we get started on all that, here is Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
On what was meant to be the first day of a 3-day ceasefire in Gaza, dozens of people have died. The truce lasted just a few hours. Israel resumed operations, saying Hamas had fired rockets just 90 minutes into the ceasefire. Israeli forces are now searching for a soldier who's believed to have been abducted. And Gaza's health ministry says 53 people have been killed in the latest Israeli shelling. Dutch and Australian forensic experts have returned to the scene of the Malaysia Airlines crash in eastern Ukraine. A 70-strong team's now set up a base, but fighting has continued nearby. In Uganda, the country's constitutional court has struck down its harsh anti-homosexuality laws. It's 6 months since they came into force with long prison sentences. A number of Western countries cut aid to Uganda in response, but the government could challenge today's ruling. And the World Health Organization has said the Ebola outbreak in West Africa can be contained, but affected nations need more help from other countries. More than 700 people have died across Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea, and quarantines are now being imposed in the worst affected areas. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Win Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Monocle 24 and this is Midori House. The time is 21:34 in Moscow, 18:34 here in London and 14:34 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Vermont, where Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg joins us now. Welcome to the program, Sasha. Shall we start with New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, who finds himself in the middle of quite a massive scandal?
That
that Cuomo aides had been sort of meddling in the commission that they created when the commissioners tried to subpoena some folks who had ties to the Cuomo administration, and Cuomo ended up disbanding this committee. And now we learned just yesterday that the federal prosecutors are looking into whether the way that Cuomo interfered with this committee could...
Sasha, are you still there? It seems that Sasha is not on the line anymore, so we take a very short break and try again after this.
What's big and beautiful and has a sunny disposition? It is, of course, our annual summer newspaper, Monocle Mediterraneo. This large format newspaper lets us go on holiday with you and delivers a breezy mix of great reporting from mednations and beyond, gripping fiction, bright fashion and delicious treats. And here are our editors to tell you what else they've got lined up for you.
In the affairs section, we take to the skies with Portugal's search and rescue helicopter team. And we also meet the bright new Tunisian minister hoping to transform the country's tourism industry.
In the business section, we profile 10 classic summer products that are ripe for a comeback, including the beach buggy, the deck chair, and the fedora. We sniff out a family-run perfumier in Barcelona and run down the businesses lining the coasts and riding the waves of the Mediterranean, who rely on the region's unique riches to keep them afloat.
Monocle Mediterraneo is on newsstands now, or find out more at monocle.com. Oh, and have a great summer.
And welcome back. So, Sasha Eisenberg in the US. You know what North American phone lines are like. We'll get back to him a bit later. But first, we continue with our short story for this week. Monocle's summer newspaper Mediterraneo is now on a newsstand near you. And among the many highlights contained therein is a murder mystery by Anne Zerudi, author of the Hermes Diactoros series of defective novels. For Monocle's Mediterraneo, she wrote an exclusive tale, Murder Mystery in the Isles, and here is chapter 5.
Murder Mystery in the Isles by Anne Zerudi. In a house on a Greek island, a man lies seriously ill in bed, tended to by his aunt. Meanwhile, a mysterious man arrives in town to visit an ancient shrine and drink the spring waters, but the water has stopped flowing. And soon the man's investigations reveal that there are turbulent depths beneath the island's calm surface.
In search of a nightcap, the fat man wandered back along the harbour to where the evening was livelier. He chose a busy bar, finding a stool inside where the air conditioning made the place cool. On the bar was a cocktail menu, a lengthy list with photographs of brightly coloured drinks containing fruit and paper umbrellas. "What can I get you?" asked the barman.
"I've never tried one of these things," said the fat man. How about a chocolate martini?"
The barman presented him with an elegant glass of white chocolate cream stirred through with dark chocolate syrup. "How is it?" asked the barman.
"Sweet. What do you put in it?" "Vanilla vodka, creme de cacao, a little Godiva chocolate liqueur." "You'd never know it was alcoholic," said the fat man. "I'd serve it to a child." "Oh, it's got a kick to it," said the barman. "Two or three of those will get you singing, but that's vodka for you. It's in there, but you can't taste it."
The fat man looked thoughtful. "Interesting," he said, "but I don't think chocolate martini is my drink." He pushed the glass away. "I wonder if you could make me a Campari soda." The next morning, the fat man returned to the public telephone. This time, when he dialed, a man answered.
"Calimera," said the fat man. "I'm wondering if you've had time to check on Faith Not Felony." "I have, but you owe me, Hermes. Other people pay me for this kind of work."
"Dinner, then, when I return to Athens. As long as you bring your beautiful wife." "You neglect her, Elias, and that is careless." "Dinner at the restaurant of my choice?" "Your choice, yes."
Then listen to this. I think you'll find it very interesting indeed. The fat man climbed the wide stone steps to the upper town, admiring the views of the open sea, marvellous blue and glinting in the sunlight, and the haze-softened outline of the distant mainland. He asked a woman for directions. As she answered him, she looked him over curiously, taking in the careful tailoring of his clothes and the anomaly of his white shoes. "Along here, right, right, and then left," she said. "It's the house with the bougainvillea." He followed her instructions and found the house, its courtyard gateway shaded with vivid pink blossoms. The gate was ajar, and he called out, "Is anyone there?" Chrysanthe opened the gate. Her eyes were red and swollen. "Forgive my intrusion," said the fat man. "I've come to offer my condolences." She stood back to allow him to pass and followed him into the courtyard. Sitting at a table there was a priest. "Ah, Papa Lefteris," said the fat man. "We meet again." "Yassas," said Papa Lefteris. "So it seems." The fat man turned to Chrysanthe and held out his hand. When she gave hers, he held it firmly. "I am deeply sorry for your loss," he said. "May Gika's memory be eternal. I know you were like a mother to him." Sniffing back tears, she dabbed at her eyes with a damp handkerchief. "I was," she said, "and I was glad to be so. He loved me like a son, Calais, like my own son." The priest raised an eyebrow but said nothing. "Sit down, Calais, sit. Can I get you something to drink?" "Thank you," said the fat man, taking a chair opposite the priest. "It's hot and the walk up from the port isn't easy. A glass of water, if you have one?" Chrysanthe blew her nose and went inside the house. The fat man gave the priest a genial smile. "I'm pleased to find you here," he said. "You saved me coming to find you. I assume this lady is your parishioner?" "Actually, no," said Papa Lefteris. "This house falls in the parish of my colleague, Papa Linos. But in difficult times, we're all one family in God. I'm here to pay my respects, as, it seems, are you." "Are these difficult times, then?" "For Chrysanthe, of course." "And for you?" "Are you here to pay your respects, or to remove any evidence?" The priest frowned. "Evidence? Evidence of what?" "Faith, not felony. How much do you know about Gika's enterprise, Papa?" "Enterprise? It's a charitable institution set up to..." The fat man had held up his hand. "I know what it was set up to do," he said. "It put money into Gika's bank account. When did you discover you had been duped?" The priest sighed. "We should have been suspicious from the start," he said. "Gikas was never known for his charitable nature, but his idea touched my sympathies. I wonder now whether he used his friends in high places to do a little digging into my background. We all have skeletons in our closets, and mine is a son who's serving time. This island was a fresh start for my wife and me after the disgrace of his criminality. But there was never any communications from Florida that I saw. Gikas had a friend who was handling the accounts, and though we had reports on the numbers, how could we know where the money was actually going? It wasn't a huge amount, but enough to make it worth his while. He was clever enough to make the church pay his setup costs, and I accepted the car. That was shrewd. If the scheme was exposed, of course, it would look as if we were in on it. We've been stupid, but our intentions were honourable. You have my word on that. You might take heart from the fact that his accountant is unlikely to come forward," said the fat man. "If anything does come out, you'll have to make the case for your innocence in the courts. But if you make things right with the people here, that would surely be in your favour. I think you know what I mean. Chrysanthe brought out a glass of water, and the fat man drank it down. That's the well water I've drunk nearly all my life, she said. If I'd given it to Geekus, things might have been different. There's goodness in that water that might have saved him. What did you give him instead? Asked the fat man. Papa Lefteri's water from St. Marina, said Chrysanthe. Dr. Kyriakos carried it up here himself and told me to give Geekus nothing else. There's a bottle or two left if you'd like one for your journey. Thank you, said the fat man. That's very kind.
Murder Mystery in the Isles was performed by Karen Cogan and written by Anne Zarudi. It's an original drama produced for Monocle 24 by Paul Noble.
That was indeed the latest chapter of our Mediterranean murder mystery by Anne Zarudi. And stay tuned on Monday when the final part of our murdery mystery concludes. All will be revealed. Meanwhile, already a few minutes ago, we tried to have a chat with our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, and Sasha is back now and joining us on the line. So we already discussed what's going on with New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo, who finds himself in the middle of a scandal. It sounds like he was leading this massive anti-corruption push until it became uncomfortable for himself.
That's right. Almost inevitably, things kind of turned back on reformers rather quickly, and he sort of set himself up a lot like Chris Christie next door in New Jersey, somebody who hadn't made a lot of friends and kind of went in claiming that he was going to clean up a swamp, and it kind of sucked him in too. And he now is in a very difficult position, squeezed by a news media that's covering him very aggressively, and also by a federal prosecutor who sees the possibility of a potential criminal prosecution.
Let's continue with another politician in the U.S. GOP gubernatorial candidate Neil Kashkari has spent a week playing homeless. Sasha, where is the significance of this story? It sounds like a PR stunt for me.
Yeah, it certainly is a PR stunt, but it's a more immersive one than we've seen in the past. Anil Kashkari is the Republican candidate running against Jerry Brown in California. Nobody gives him much of a chance. He's a it's obviously a very Democratic state, and he is a former banker who ended up overseeing the federal bailout fund for the Treasury Department. But what he's done, he spent a week, he showed up in Fresno, California, sort of working class city in the center of the state with, he claimed $40 in cash, no job. He's a sort of fit 41-year-old, and no place to stay, and as you note, a video crew, and couldn't find a job. And you actually see him in this surprisingly well-produced video for a piece of political propaganda, sleeping on park benches and going in shop by shop, asking for a job and being told there aren't any. It definitely is a stunt. It's a rather well-done stunt, as these things go, and actually showed some real commitment on his part. It was apparently a week that he spent doing this. And, you know, this is kind of an extreme example, but we see and have heard about the inability of Republicans to connect across class lines and also racial and ethnic lines in the United States. And this is probably the most clear performance by a Republican who understands that the party is seen as a party of rich people and that needs to, if they're going to talk about job creation, as he does at the end of this film, that they need to do with a sense of empathy that they're, you know, doing it for real normal people who are suffering and not just in the interests of shareholders or investors.
So can I just double check with you? Do you think this trick is going to work? Do you think this is going to boost his popularity?
I think it's the type of thing that will break through for a guy who, you know, is down by quite a margin. I don't think it changes the dynamics of the race. Jerry Brown is still a sort of popular Democratic governor who's seen as an incredible success in a state that hasn't elected a Republican to that office. Well, that's Schwarzenegger, but it's not a state that elects a lot of Republicans to statewide office. So I do think as these things, you know, we've seen a lot of politicians who say, I'm going to move into public housing for a few days, or I'm going to see if I can last on food stamps. camps for a week. One of the things is the change in the media environment means that he was probably followed around by, you know, a staffer with a single video camera, and I think that you can sort of get a more intimate look at what these, what that's like in the life of a politician than it would have been in the old days if you really have to tramp around with the whole camera crew.
That was Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. Thank you very much. In a moment, we'll review the week's best films out of Italy, but to get us in the mood, we have a bit of music. This is Giorgia with Tu mi porti su.
Cadere, tu mi porti su, poi mi lasci cadere. Quando t'ho incontrato è scattato il gioco della seduzione.
I hope that song got you in the right mood. It definitely did that for me. That was Giorgia with Tu mi porti su. You are listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House. And it is time now to review the best and sometimes worst in the worlds of television, theatre, books and more. Today we talk film. Joining us now is Luca Mastrantonio, who writes on Italian film for Corriere della Sera. Welcome to the program, Luca. We start with a film that translates as Human Capital. It is called Il Capitale Umano. What do you want to tell us about that? I've heard it's actually one of your favorites, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the best of the last season, and it's freely inspired by the novel of the American writer, of course. And it's shot by Paolo Virgì, a Tuscan, great filmmaker. And the story is a thriller around an accident occurred to a cyclist victim by a SUV, but the thriller aspect who is the criminal, is just an opportunity, an occasion, to look into a particular place of Italy called Brianza. It's a place in the north where, speaking generally, of course, people are rich, cynic, proud, like self-made men, but sometimes more similar to a financial shark. In fact, the most famous quote of the film is, "We bet on the collapse of Italy, and we will, and we won." It's the quote of the poster and on the web reviews really, really liked for understand the spirit of the film. So with a lot of character, a lot of turns of events, and the characters are divided by social and anagraphical elements, it's a complex and dark social drama of contemporary Italy. I mean, it's good for a winter raining day, not for the summer.
Exactly.
But anyway, I like it, yeah.
Well, you make it sound so good that I actually want to hear a clip of what it all actually sounds like.
E adesso, finalmente, ci godiamo quello che ci spetta.
Il vincitore del premio Contafavi 2010. And the winner is...
And it sounds good indeed. So, look, just out of curiosity, how many points would you give it on the scale from 1 to 10?
Sorry, can you repeat?
How many points would you give this film from 1 to 10?
Yeah, I think 8.
Okay, let's continue with another film then. The next one is called La Mafia Uccide Solo d'Estate, which translates as The Mafia Only Kills in the Summer. And this is a clip of the trailer.
Hanno dimostrato che lo Stato non è con noi!
Tranquillo. Someone has already called this the best film ever made about the mafia. Luca, what's going on in this film?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great sentence. But of course, it was the first film of Pier Francesco Di Liberto, a young filmmaker. Maybe it's the best of a young filmmaker. But, of course, the title is interesting because it's a reference of the father of the protagonist and means mafia kills only when people are on holidays, when media are distracted, careless. And so I think it's a clever point of view. It's a tragic comic trip in Sicily. We are around 90s. And in Italy there was a clash, a fight between the mafia and state, policemen, politicians were killed. But the particularity of the film is that it focuses on the grown-up of a young adult boy, shy but creative. The film is also about love, innocence, fear and rage. So it's not heavy, it's not black and white. And maybe that's the new thing about telling about mafia. And the filmmaker was born in Palermo in the 1972, maybe because new generation gives new point of view.
Exactly. And how many points from 1 to 10?
Yeah, I mean, maybe 8 to...
Okay, let's continue with one more film. I don't want to run out of time. This one is a comedy. It's called Sole a Catinille, and this is what it sounds like.
Philip, Pino, mi portate un cocktail per cortesia?
Tortello di zucca in salsa di pistacchio.
This film actually has proven to be very successful. It's already second top-grossing film in Italy of all time. What is it all about?
Yeah, it's about Italian people now. It's a portrait of Italy like a country of wannabe men. Maybe you can hear the accent of the actor Checco Zalone we heard in the clip. It's a Apulian comic, great comic, and it's about Italy now. It's incredible the success of this film because it's a sort of it's a miracle in anthropological way because it's a parody of the Berlusconian everyman who amused both people who love Berlusconi and people who hate him. So it's the first time maybe Italy, I mean, since the last World Soccer Championship we won, we made something together watching this film. And it's a trip of a father, a wannabe self-made man with his son, in the south of Italy, meeting radical chic, bobos, and other social animals living at the moment mm-hmm. in Italy.
How many points?
I mean, I don't want to be so easy, but I have to say maybe 9.
Wow, that's good. That was Luca Mastrantonio from Corriere della Sera. Thank you very much for this. And that's actually already all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Tim Marshall and Jim Hoare. Today's show is produced by Phil Hahn, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lucy Atkinson. And our studio manager was Sean Malervi. For this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.